Hey friends, mark your calendars. The Intentional Motherhood Retreat is coming up October 23rd through 25th in Portland, Oregon. It's a meaningful few days to slow down, connect, and refocus on what matters most in your motherhood journey. Also, some exciting news, Intentional Fatherhood has officially launched on all podcast platforms, including YouTube. So go subscribe, check out the first few episodes, and share it with all the fathers in your life. For more details and registration info for the Motherhood Retreat, you can go to intentionalparents.org, or you can go check out our new website for fathers, intentionalfatherhood.org. You're listening to the Intentional Parents Podcast, brought to you by Intentional. Intentional is all about spiritual formation in the family. We desire to bring biblical hope and practical help. Enjoy this week's conversation. I do want to just highlight as we start right now, how hard it is to get this group to start a podcast.
Because you're actually recording right now, right?
Yeah. I mean, I basically have to record and then just wait for everyone. Okay, let's start.
Well, hi, Miles. So you're having to listen to all this.
No, Miles stuff. I think, so everyone, so you know,
Miles. Hi, Miles.
Miles is a wonderful, wonderful human.
Yes,
he has a wonderful company called Down South. Go check it out. This is a shameless plug for him. He's not asking. Mm-hmm. But based out of Nashville, great friend. He does all of our editing.
Our podcast would not exist without Miles Albritton.
And so this is a shameless plug. Please, if you need some help in this arena, go check out Down South. Mm-hmm. That said, we're here. We're going to answer some questions, or rather respond to some questions, because that really is something that continues to come to the surface. Lots of questions, whether email or through social media or through any avenue we can receive questions. We have a steady stream of questions. And so recently, some of you folks who still love writing a lot send emails, which is amazing, long form questions. So we decided, as we've been kind of stacking those up and saving them, what if we responded to some of those? Because they are long form questions, so I won't read the whole length of them, but I think there's some really, really insightful questions. So thank you to everybody who has actually sent in some questions. And if you are curious at all, like, email info@intentionalparents.org, and you can send in a question at any time. And also, thank you for everyone that's rated and subscribed and left a comment. It means the world. We're on YouTube now. The other day, someone said, who listens often, said, I didn't even know you were on YouTube. And I was like, I think we say it at the beginning of every episode. Like, how have you missed it every time? So anyway, you can go check this out on YouTube as well, if that's helpful. But we wanted to respond to some questions today. We're getting ready for the Motherhood Retreat. Diane and Elizabeth were just away for 2 days, specifically writing, which was really fun. Mm-hmm. Well, at least I heard it was fun. Saw photos. Mm-hmm. Seemed like it was fun. You were both alone.
It's amazing.
Fun's probably the wrong word. It was intense and it was
productive.
Satisfying.
Yes.
And productive.
And satisfying. Yes. It's amazing. You can get a lot done without kids around and when you're not in your own house.
I think you can. Certain people probably could do, depending upon your personality type, you've always done better when we're out of the house. You do not even vacation. Like, staycation is a bad word for you. You do not vacation well if you're working.
My version of a staycation would be to stay home and do house projects.
Well, I had your kids and I got nothing done.
Yeah.
Just so you know.
And they're older now.
But it was a joy to have them. They were a blast.
It's a lot. Well, yeah, because I was out of town at the same time. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we had
Pops
an overlap.
Came through.
Pops,
they had a blast.
The super Pops. Yeah, it's funny because, yeah, our kids are at the stage now where it's a lot easier to just hang in there. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but the Motherhood Retreat, that's coming. So you'll hear about that. But please, if you haven't had a chance to sign up, I think by the time this launches, we will only have so much time left before the Motherhood Retreat. It's coming. It's getting here. Fall time, school time, all that. But let me start with some questions. I'm going to start with a pretty simple one. I'm not going to say everyone's name, but I know this guy. So Bennett, what a good dude. I won't say your last name, but thank you for this question. Love when the dudes send some questions in. Because moms, I want to say this. You're so faithful to sending questions. Dads are slow to sending questions, predominantly, if you were to compare. So it's always nice to just have a moment to be like, yes, father's asking curious questions. So he's just saying, our oldest son is so emotional. Totally can understand that. Can he grow out of it? And how can we discipline through that? So really emotional, will he grow out of it? Or how do we discipline through that? Hmm. Emotions. Let's start with those. Feels so good. Phil is feeling emotional today. He's feeling a lot today. I won't go into detail, but no, but I mean like feelings, emotions, feeling a lot. I think that's a big deal. We have some kids with big emotions. Mm-hmm. And will they grow out of it? I think I'm trying to think of depends on the kid. You know, it depends on the depends on the actual.
I think it's not. You have to look at it through the lens of not will they grow out of it, and more through the lens of can we teach them to express it in a healthy way. Yes,
that's a great way to say it.
Because I think especially when our kids are little, I mean our youngest right now, lots of big emotions, and any expression of them is extremely external and goes on forever and ever and ever and ever. So we're navigating this with her of how do we like create space for her to feel and express how she's feeling, create that safety where she's able to tell us what she's feeling. But at some point, she has to also be able to move on with their day.
Are you talking about our youngest child?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Maybe you should talk about how you're handling
it. Well, I was just going to say last night we were out to dinner. Our friend Josh White's in town. Mm-hmm. So we had dinner together and Phil and Diane, we were all there. Sloan, our little sweetheart, was with Elizabeth. Our son Duke started driving. That's a new deal. So I was in the passenger seat. He's driving home.
We had two cars.
Yeah. That's why. Yeah, there we go. Thank you. And she, you know, Sloan was really wanting to go with Duke and I really quick. And so
she was crying and crying and crying because she wanted to get in your car.
And the so she then so Elizabeth like waves me over and or Duke rather because he's driving. So Duke pulls up next to her and I was like, "What is everything okay?" And she says, Sloan really wants to go with you guys. I mean, it's literally a 2.5 minute drive home from where we were eating. And so I was like, okay, yeah, no problem. It wasn't a big deal. So she gets in the car, buckles up, you pull out and you go, you start driving away. And then she like looks out the window and she's like, I want to go with mom. And she's like, just, but like, it wasn't a small cry. It was like, she was deeply upset.
Very loud about her emotions.
And I was like, what? You said you wanted to come with us. And she's like, I don't want to go with you. I want to go with mom. And I was like, I'm sorry, but like we're in it now. We got to get home. Like we can't do anything. So as far as how we handled it, like in that situation, it was like, at first I was trying to figure out. So I just calmly tried to ask questions like, okay, so I thought you wanted to go with us. Am I wrong? And she's like, no, I want to go with mom. I was like, then why did you ask mom to go with me? I was just trying to like reason with her, which in that state, she's like, no, big no tears. Reason. There's no reasoning. She's like, this is just terrible. And I was like, well, I have to stop at Alma and Pop's house to grab something. So you can come with me and you can say hi to Trooper, their dog. I was trying to like give some, you can say hi to Trooper. I already saw him today. I didn't want to see him anymore. I was like, oh my goodness. And then I was like, okay, well, so Duke stops the car. I went into your house when you weren't there and I was stealing things. And no, I'm just kidding. I had to grab something. And then she comes into the house and she's still like, and I said, Sloan, listen, I understand you're feeling a lot, but do not bring that in here right now, please. I need a minute. And she's like, oh, and she kind of just like puts her hands down and she like walks out. And it's because I knew I was going to be in the car in a second to talk with her. And I was like, I need some space for a second. I need to calm down. Cause she was like, she was going and going and going. So I was trying to draw just a normal, healthy boundary, but I was like, I need a second. And so then I go back out to the car and she's in the car. She's still whimpering. I'm like, Sloan, listen, I'm sorry if I was rude, but I need you to understand that I am feeling a lot about you feeling a lot. And I need you to, can you calm down? I need you to calm down if you can. And she's like, I just really want to go with mom. And so anyway, I was like, I know, but we didn't do that. And mom's going to be home. We'll be home in a second, you know? And then basically as soon as she kept whimpering the whole way home and I just had to basically absorb and try to, what's the right word? Redirect. So she tried to redirect until we got home. And then when she got home, she was distracted enough to like kind of be fine with it. So anyway, that's how that situation happened. But I mean, that type of situation happens
is a very regular
thing.
But the most effective thing, I mean, it's not always possible in when you're in the car and you're trying to like in the situation last night, but what we found with her is the most effective thing is when we stop everything and we pick her up and hold her tight. Physical touch is big for her.
Huge, yeah.
She's like a little more sensory seeking. So you just squeeze her real tight and just, I see that you're really sad. Try to name the emotions for her. Mm-hmm. Or you were really mad that you weren't able to go with mom. And just hold her and sit with her. That's the fastest way to help her calm down and re-regulate. It's not possible every time. But I think with the kids who feel, all kids feel a lot. All humans feel a lot. It's just that sometimes we suppress it or we start distracting ourselves so that we don't have to feel it as much. And then there are those who are extremely expressive about it. So it sounds like this person who asked the question, sounds like their son is probably quite expressive or cries or is very emotional. I had a therapist tell me one time, it's the kids who are quiet that you need to worry about the most. Mm-hmm. So I would say the fact that he's expressive is actually a beautiful thing. And
you just gave a whole genre of people. You gave a whole bunch of people more stress right now. You relieved a handful and just stressed out a handful.
I know. Well, we can talk more about those quiet kids in a minute.
No, I know.
But I would say the fact that he sounds like he's expressive is actually a good thing. And that's your window. You meet him in his overdoing it of expressing. Yeah. And you meet him and help him name what he's actually feeling. And the more you do that, the more you bring connection when he's feeling a lot, because that's probably what he's asking for, is some sort of connection. Do you see me? Do you care that I'm here? If you can bring that and then slowly start to add in after he feels very seen and known and heard, I would say even create space for him that it's okay to be expressive about those emotions.
Totally.
And then over time, now I don't know how old he is, but then over time, you have to start also teaching.
He's like 5 or 6.
Okay. So perfect age to start also teaching. Mm-hmm. It's absolutely okay to feel a lot and to feel very sad about that. But when you go on crying and crying and crying, kind of hurts everybody's ears. It doesn't actually help you be able to get to a place of accepting. Yeah. Like you have to teach them the next step of like, there is a point where I would say overly expressing, it just becomes unhelpful.
We want to let you know about a new offering, a 31-day prayer devotional entitled Sowing a Hidden Seed, Daily Prayers for Your Child's Spiritual Growth. This book was born out of desperation. I didn't know how to lead my kids spiritually, so I started praying honest, dependent, daily prayers. Jeremiah 29:12 says, "Then you will call on me," God says, "and come and pray to me, and I will listen to you." If you want to learn more, head to intentionalparents.org. And if you partner with us at $25 a month or more, we'd love to send you a copy as a thank you.
Yeah. So, and Phil and Diana, I'd love your wisdom on this or any perspective you have. Just on that point, though, the pendulum in our culture is swinging to like, let's let our kids feel everything and their emotions kind of, we can't suppress, squash, move, direct or redirect emotions. They have to be felt in their full extent. And I would say yes and no. I would say yes, we need to make space for exactly, you know, what they're feeling. We need to not invalidate it, but we also have a responsibility to have a certain level of self-control when they can't be their own self-control. So with our youngest one, it's like she doesn't always fully know how to have self-control. So there's a part where we have to step in. Often it's like we'll have listened to her, we'll have given her ample space, we'll have cuddled, we'll have talked, and there's still just a general like just whimpering and kind of pouting, whining.
Well, it happened the other day. Birdie was invited to a birthday party that Sloan wasn't old enough to go to. So far they've always somehow managed to both get invited. And we were looking at this is a good thing. This is a normal life thing. This is gonna start happening more and more as they get older. And it went from like really sad, crying, really disappointed, all the way to our drive to church, all the way through church, way home from church, not crying, but pouting.
Yeah.
And so we were both looking at each other of like, okay, we need to start working on
there
this
must
with
be
her.
An expiration date on this mood.
Yes. Yeah. And it doesn't, we have to be careful as parents not to like meet them in their emotion and then it goes on too long. We start feeling too much, and now we're just shaming them and squashing them.
Which, by the way, we've done, and we do.
We've like, absolutely done that.
In our own. So, like, let's be real. That does happen because there's a line where it's like, "Are you kidding?" And even last night, not having enough bandwidth in the moment. We couldn't slow down. It wasn't like in that moment I could just stop turn everything off.
Yeah. Anyway,
keep going.
But I think I had a thought and I just lost it. I had a thought in that same vein. Oh, that this is where we talk a lot about the tool of encouragement and how powerful mm-hmm. it is. Also yes. with Sloan, we're starting to notice anytime she is disappointed and she doesn't go on and on and on, that's a yeah. window to say,
great
I
job,
am
yeah.
so proud of you
yep.
accepting the thing that was disappointing. Mm-hmm. I'm so proud of you. You're really accepting that and you're really having a good attitude. Mm-hmm. And she yeah. just stands up a little taller. And
yeah. That's a great reminder.
So I think it's a both and, but I think somewhere in the question was, how do I discipline it out of them? I think that's the wrong question.
Or how do you discipline through it?
Through it.
Like the idea, not out of them. Like, got how it. Do you discipline while that's going yeah. on? And
you can't. You got to wait till they're calm.
But what did you do after that one that went all the way through church?
So I was going to say, yeah. there was a line where I sat down to finish that whole line of thinking is, I said, we just sat down and logically said, Sloan.
After church, after we yeah. got home.
It's like, yeah. You've been now going on for almost 3 hours. There's no doubt that you're upset. I get it. But you also need to understand that this isn't going to change and you can still have a good day and you can still have a fun day and you can still have fun. Like we were already ideating, like how can we make some time special for her so that she doesn't feel like she's been left out completely. So we had already talked about like, okay, if Birdie's going to go to the birthday party, we understand that might be disappointing to soften the blow a little bit because we know that could be hard for her. Elizabeth's like, well, why don't I take you on a date? Just you and me, you know, not trying to like do a whole big deal. It was something that
no,
we had.
No, she asked if we'd go to a toy store and I could buy her something. I said, no, I'm not going to go buy yeah. you something, but we can go
spend
to
time
a coffee
together.
Shop. We can go to a park. I gave her a bunch of options of connecting yeah. things.
Yeah.
And she kept asking, but can we go to the toy store? I said, yeah. no, yeah. we can go to a park. We can go. And we ended up going to a coffee shop in a park and then got a text from
a friend
yeah. asking if she could come over and play with their daughter. So she ended up doing like an all-day play date. And we had a great conversation that night about God and how, look, you were so disappointed and look at the day God gave you. Like he gave you a surprising day. We got to go on a date and then you got to spend all day at a friend's house who she's only ever been to at with Birdie.
So,
she got
really
to have
special.
Her own alone time.
But to finish that up is just to say like we had to draw the line and say, so now listen, I don't want to give you a consequence for this, but if you do not choose to listen to us now it's going to become a problem. Mm-hmm. So we gave her a lot of time before we had to draw the line. And the hope wasn't to threaten. It was just to say, if you can't be your own self-control, we have to teach you what self-control looks like. Self-control is stopping even though you don't really feel like stopping. So that's how we did it. And she ended up actually doing it. For some of our kids, it's been moments where it's like, okay, well, we have to move to the next level because you're not hearing us. And I think you have to be careful not to rush to that because a lot of the times it's just they're emotionally, at least with our kids, they're emotionally so heightened that you have to wait for them to come down to even rationally talk to them. Mm-hmm. She was totally out of the irrational spot. She was just upset. But Sloan, especially out of all of our kids, is also probably one of the most – she's very curious even about God right now. You were talking to her yesterday mm-hmm. about God. Even this morning she came to me. There's this little school that they might be getting in or not. We're not sure yet. We have to wait to find out. And she was saying, Dad, I've been praying that I get into this school because I really want to go. And mm-hmm. I was like, wow, when have you been praying? You know, like she just told me this morning before we left. And she said, well, when I was in bed once really quick and then another time when I was with her friend Grace, she's like, well, when I was with Grace, I thought about it and I've been praying about that. That's so wow. cool. So this kid that is, I think, has a lot of emotions also is really in tuned with God in a beautiful, deep yeah. way. And sometimes I think there is some real connection with that. Some of those kids that have maybe higher emotions or more sensitive dispositions have a beautiful mm-hmm. sensitivity to Jesus yeah. and the Spirit in a way yeah. that our others don't.
And gosh, we need more men like that. Like with the fact that this is a little boy, the question yeah. being asked,
yeah.
I think I can see that there could be fear behind that. What's that going to become? But I actually think it could be a real gift.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Okay. We've talked a lot. You guys have anything
Any thoughts?
To add?
Hey, Brooke here with Intentional. Just wanted to pause really quick and say thank you to all of our legacy builders and invite you to potentially become one today. If you didn't know, Intentional is a crowdfunded nonprofit, which is all about spiritual formation in the family. We desire to bring biblical hope, practical help, and healing to families all around the world, in marriage, in parenting, in grandparenting, in all sorts of relationships. We can only do that with you, our partners, our legacy builders. If you're curious what a legacy builder is, that's simply a person who's decided to say, not only do I want to pray for Intentional, I want to help Intentional, even in financial terms, to help fuel this ministry and this mission forward. So if you haven't had an opportunity to check that out, you can go to intentionalparents.org. You can click the link in the show notes, but we just want to invite you today. Pray about becoming a legacy builder and partnering with us in a deeper way to help families all around the world. All right, back to this week's episode.
Bazillion thoughts going through my mind. The primary one, I think, for me would be the balance. You know, the fact that you're doing both and you're teaching self, you're being her self-control.
Yeah.
After you have helped her identify what exactly she is feeling. Mm-hmm. Because so many people with adults with big emotions go straight to anger because they may not even really be angry. They just don't know what how to process disappointment or shame or so many other fear. And so they go straight to anger because it kind of solves some things. Mm-hmm. It gets people out of their way and it feels good in the moment.
Yeah.
So the idea that you're helping her to name her emotions, I think that's really, really important. But at the same time, those people with big emotions can destroy their relationships. So if we're going to teach her to, or him, this little boy, to love God and love people, that's a skill that is going to have to be able to override those big emotions at that time. Mm-hmm. So it's really important he understand what he's feeling. The other thing that keeps coming to mind is I was raised in an era where this big emotions were unacceptable.
Yeah.
At least in the American culture, at least in my home. There were lots of big emotions in my home, but they were unacceptable. Yeah. So it's not like we had a real peaceful, emotionally honest home. It's more that only the adults were allowed to feel things big. And so for me, who I think, you know, you do those personality tests and then the one on that has a lot to do with feelings, a highly sensitive person. I qualify on every level of the highly sensitive person, but I learned, was taught, was trained to shut those down and to swallow them and then just absorb them. And I think there were two things. I'm really thankful that for the most part, my parents taught me emotional self-control. I could turn it off. And I'm really sorry that they didn't understand what is being talked about even right now. Because behavior was everything in that era. That I'm really sorry that they weren't able to value the big emotions that they also had.
Yeah.
And be able to think them through and pray them through and see that David was this highly emotional person. And he goes to anger quite frequently. And he goes to depression. And he goes to anxiety. And he goes to fear. And he has learned the key. And this is probably the last thing I want to say is your whole end goal is for that little boy when he feels, when he's 25 and he's 35 and he's 65. And he feels that big welling up of emotion to be able to take those straight to the Lord and hide in him. That's what David did. He's always talking about hiding in him, running into him as into a strong tower. And processing first with the Lord. And then by the time he's done processing with the Lord, he's like calm and cool headed. It's not that he didn't feel those things. It's that now he's worked out the angst. And I think that's where the balance is. You cannot just let our children run roughshod over other people or in a restaurant or at church or places where they're disrupting other people as if, you know, that's like raising a narcissist right there. The only thing that's important right now is what I'm feeling. So you have to have limits and boundaries, but to be able to help them name their emotions, mm-hmm. that's, to me, that's just everything.
It's huge.
Yes.
I'm 65 years old, and I'm just learning how to name these emotions. And then one more thing. I read an article in Psychology Today that differentiates officially. We'll probably never be able to get this vocabulary right. But between emotions and feelings.
Hmm.
So they actually had definitions. I don't have them with me here right now. So here's a very amateurish way of saying it. Emotions you cannot help but feel. So this little five-year-old boy, he can't help it because he feels them in his body.
Mm-hmm.
It's a physical sensation that comes to him. Feelings are the thought processes that go through dealing with those physical emotions. And so that takes me to Philippians 4:8. Think on these things, Paul said. And, and it's in the middle of this very emotional passage about anxiety and about fear and about obsessive thoughts. And then he says, finally he says, think on these things, whatever is lovely. Phil, you've got it memorized, I'm sure.
Whatever is true, whatever is lovely, whatever is of good reputation, pure, let your mind dwell in these things. That's not the whole list, but there's a list there of the kind of things that we're to think on.
Yes.
Because right thinking leads to right
actions.
Living and action.
Yeah. So emotions, feelings, and thinking. I think maybe we need to stop using feelings and emotions as synonyms and kind of correct our vocabulary a little bit according to Psychology Today.
Yeah.
And according to the scripture. What did we read in that book, Elizabeth? How many thoughts a day?
6,000.
We think an average of 6,000 thoughts a day. So training a little boy, training Sloan, training ourselves to think about what we think about and to take those emotions, don't stuff them down and ignore them, but to think about them and say, well, why am I feeling so angry? And is it really anger that I'm feeling? That just seems to be part of the training that an emotionally present parent is able to do with their kids. And what a gift. What a gift.
Yeah. Well, I do have, Phil, I want to hear your responses, but to this next question, because this one's specifically for you guys, and I think it's a really thoughtful, unique question. I really actually think. So, This person had texted a question. I would really love hearing Phil and Diane's perspective on the culture when they became believers and little tidbits that they shared on some episodes. We'll refer to that in a minute. She said, I think it's a gal here. She says, my parents also became believers during the 60s and 70s. And while I think for them it was life-giving and freeing, some sort of repercussive all-in faith, it caused a lot of confusing messages to them growing up in a household as children. Would Phil and Diane be able to dive into some of the nuances of the culture at that time? Because she's hoping to translate, you know, and understand what's going on with her parents. So maybe when you guys got saved, what was some of the things going on maybe in the Christian world and some of the nuances of that time? And I would say maybe we already know, like there was a higher level of moralism going on during that time.
But there was a reason for it.
There was a reason for it. No, there's reason for it.
Can
of course.
I set up a little bit more before we pass it to
please
them?
Do.
Because I love this question. And I think it's so important. And I think we've talked about it on here before, but what I feel like is we're seeing more and more and more is that in our current moment, it's like we've lost the ability to see context and history. But history is so important to all the things that we are wrestling with and probably overdoing right now because of history. And so we have this whole, I mean, I feel like a lot of our peers, we have whole multiple generations now who are not understanding context of where you guys came from or, you know, generations past, and who are just kind of throwing out the baby with the bathwater, so to speak, and kind of demonizing
a
lot of what has been done without taking the time to understand the context. But when you understand the context, there just comes a lot of clarity and understanding, but I think there also comes a lot of compassion. And it can take people from maybe our stage of life to go from just being angry and everything their parents did was wrong to having a lot more compassion and understanding of why certain things, I think especially in the church, were the way that they were. Mm-hmm. So this question is important. If you're tuned out right now, tune in, because I think it's really helpful. So with that, you guys. Hey, we want to remind you about the Intentional Motherhood Retreat, October 3rd through 5th. Starts on a Thursday night, ends on a Saturday morning here in Bend, Oregon, where we live. Space is filling up quickly, but we do still have some spots left. We'd love for you to come join us. Mom, what else do they need to know?
Well, this retreat really lends itself towards bringing your friends and your family, your sister, your mom, whoever with you. It is an awful lot of fun. And remember that what we're teaching is not about how to be the perfect mom, but how to really respond to God so that He can do the spiritual formation in our lives that all of us are longing for.
Yeah, so to find out more or to register, click the link in our bio, and we can't wait to see you in October.
You have a lot to say about this.
I have a lot to say about this because it's a question that has come up in different ways. This is a very well-informed question. Mm-hmm. But the hurts that I'm hearing from your generation, Elizabeth, yeah, and even younger than you, imposed on them by my generation, because our cultures have changed so drastically in the last generation. I think don't have any great quote or statistics on this, but I would guess that in this, between our generations has probably been the greatest shift in the United States, at least, as far as the way our culture thinks. Hmm. We've gone from a basically Christian culture, Christianized, Judeo-Christian ethics, Ten Commandments based. I mean, I remember in third grade, in that really pretty handwriting that they were teaching us back then, above the blackboard, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. Gosh. And how often the teacher would point to that in how we treated others. Well, that that is not part of the culture anymore. Yeah. And so we were raised in a Christianized culture, but not really a Christ-following culture. Mm-hmm. I would say it was a very moralistic, focusing on good manners, good behavior, what was acceptable and what wasn't. While lives were kind of falling apart behind the scenes. So for me, and I think Phil and I, you know, we come from different backgrounds. For me, I came from an occasionally churched background. My parents, I think, had a heart for God definitely early. They couldn't even decide whether they grew up as Christians. Mm. So we would go to churches when they kind of felt the need. No discernment as to what that church was. And yet they had some pretty good instincts too. Whereas Phil went to church every week and never heard the gospel. I went to church occasionally and also never heard the gospel. So during the Jesus movement, the context I feel from my perspective is we were in a churched America where it was pretty normal to go to church, who had no actual connection with God whatsoever. You just were doing the right moralistic, culturally correct thing to do, kind of honoring God, because He was this distant figure. When I first heard the gospel in a church that was like undergoing great revival, it was non-denominational, so, you know, perspective is everything. Neither of us were in one of the more conservative denominations when we got saved. So it wasn't like Baptist or, I mean, I never even heard some of the stuff that people believed until I was an older adult. But it was something incredible was happening in our culture. In fact, my first memory of it was we were living overseas and we weren't military, but we saw the Stars and Stripes newspaper that we would, which is the military newspaper that's put out all around the world still.
Okay.
It's on every military base, and it gets right to, I don't know how they do it, but they get it right to the bases right away. You're only usually at the very most a day behind. And we were at this military base for dinner, and there was a Stars and Stripes newspaper, and front page, top of the fold, was a picture of the Jesus Movement, and it said Jesus Movement. And it was all these young people with their hands raised and long hair and guitars playing. That was my first indication of, oh my gosh, there's something going on here that I want to be part of. So this was the Jesus Movement that was sweeping through the West Coast. I don't think it made it very much to the East Coast and the South and stuff like that. Do you know, Phil?
Yeah, I mean, it spread, but it was, everybody knew it started in Southern California.
Yeah.
And, you know, we were in Northern California, but it spread all over the West Coast and then beyond. Yeah.
And what they tried to do was take us out of this social Christianity into an actual, real, vibrant faith. And that, at least in the branch that we were part of, very much about the scriptures and about the word. You want to know God. This is his love letter to you. That was some of the language you need. This is how you get to know God, is through his word. Was very strong on worship, but not experiencing so much as actual, it was very genuine. So for us, it was revolutionary. For me, it was revolutionary to see that there was somebody now in the vernacular who saw me, soothed me, made me safe and secure. That was the message that at least that I heard.
Yeah.
This is what God and God alone can do for you.
Okay.
So for me, it was so fresh and beautiful and life-changing right before I would have otherwise made some really, really unfortunate decisions as to how to fill the hole in my heart. I will always be thankful, but I think what happened there, that was like in the 60s and 70s. And then the 80s, it became much more, administrated or organized or discipleship. Now, all of a sudden in the 80s, discipleship became a book with blank pages that you filled out. It became more knowledge based.
Okay.
But at first, the knowledge was we were just eating it up. We knew nothing about the Trinity, about the Holy Spirit. We'd grown up maybe hearing the Nicene Creed recited and not understanding it.
Yeah.
So it was the Holy Ghost, which always just gave me the willies. So we were actually learning about what the Holy Spirit does for us. So in my view, it was super healthy until it matured. And then it matured into fill-in-the-blank, knowledge-based, behavior-based,
heavy
there's
emphasis.
A right way to do it,
yeah.
And everybody's kind of the same. Mm-hmm. There's a right way to be a Christian woman. There's a right way to dress as a Christian woman. There's a right way to spend your time as a Christian woman. Mm-hmm. So it didn't mature well, unfortunately.
Yeah.
But I think the context was, man, my life was upended. Mm-hmm. But
as far as the culture it created and what I'm hearing you say, because that's kind of the heart of it. So that background's really helpful.
I would be curious.
Yeah.
Because you've done a lot of work to understand both current culture, but also psychology and emotions and the things that there just wasn't information out there like there is now. I would be curious, from your perspective, what do you think was a good thing that came into your parenting from that? And what do you think was not helpful? And that if you were to do it over again, you would do differently now with what you know now?
Oh, that is huge. That could be a series of podcasts.
Yeah. That's a good idea for an episode.
I think it's more how I responded to it personally. I think I am a born legalist, meaning I think you are too, Elizabeth.
Yeah,
100%. I was going to say, I think half your kids are. Most of your kids are.
I think because rules keep me safe. I like guidelines. No, I like boundaries.
They constrict. They choke.
Just tell me what to do and how to do it, and I will follow the guidebook.
Yeah.
So unfortunately, I brought that into, especially the early years of my parenting, because my parents didn't give their lives to Jesus until I was almost out of the house. So I wasn't raised in a Christian home. So I was going to do it right. I was going to be the perfect mom. And my kids were never going to do all sorts of things that left me feeling very hurt and ashamed of my life. So good thing, I wanted to protect you kids. Yeah. Bad thing, I put fear in you and a lack of trust in yourselves. I didn't really entrust you to God and your behavior and the consequences of that behavior. Instead, I hovered and I wanted you to be protected from making any of those bad decisions because I lived in fear of that for you because I'd made some bad decisions and I hated what it did to my life. There are scars you never recover from. So I think I overdid the protectiveness. And also in my mind, there was a formula that worked immensely well for me. And it still works well for me. Morning quiet time, reading the Bible, studying the Bible, going to church every week because you want to be part of the community. So I think some of those things, because I didn't explain them, I didn't, there wasn't a good reason in your minds behind them. And yet I found it interesting that you guys all read your Bibles every morning. You go, you guys all go to church every week. But I think our generation didn't always explain the reason why, but maybe didn't even understand the reason. I say now to be part of a community because your generation has taught me that you go to church to be part of a family. And though I experienced that, I didn't, that wasn't my primary reason. So I would say that would be the most, but then God is so faithful because I knew that the one thing I wanted for you kids, but that you would love the Lord your God with all your heart, mind, soul, and strength. That was my focus in life. And I also know I had very little control over that. So when you, Elizabeth, were just born, John Mark was six, Elizabeth would have been, I mean, Rebecca would have been three, almost three, is when the great suffering happened, knocked my feet right out from under me. I heard I was going, understood I was going to lose my hearing, totally responded horrible. We've talked about it before on the podcast. Because my faith was based on my performance and God's performance. I do this, and we were very much, well, let's put it this way. I heard that message. Whether or not we were taught that message is debatable. Very transactional. And when God didn't show up for me, it just undermined my faith. Best thing that ever happened to me, and I believe the best thing that ever happened to you kids, because all of a sudden the faith that was based on rules and routines and practices even didn't hold up when suffering and fear were overwhelming me. I now believe that, and only God, you know, can see, if I'd continued on with that kind of trajectory of faith, knowing how you kids are, that you're super intelligent, you think deeply, you feel deeply, you would have rejected that faith. It would not have done for you what it did for me. And so I think the best thing that possibly could have happened to me is that crisis of faith. That then I feel like I dove into a faith that was a little bit more talked about in a previous generation that Phil and I still find to be our go-to kind of language of it's not about me, about dying to self in the sense of my faith is not that God is going to make my life a hunky-dory and just great, follow Jesus, and you're going to have health, and you're going to have wealth, and you're going to be super successful. And introduced us to a much more real and abiding faith. So that's a long way of going on about, but I think a lot of people in that era are still in that era, and our culture has changed, and we have to change with it if we're going to be missionaries to the next generation, especially to our kids and our kids' kids.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I agree.
I've gone on and on. I feel like I've talked
too much. No, that was all very helpful. That was so good.
Phil, you have any thoughts, additions?
We have a new offering for you. If you would like to receive daily or weekly text messages and encouragement around parenting, marriage, with prayers and scriptures, click the link in the show notes and we would love to send those to you. Can't wait to connect more with you.
Well, I just don't know exactly where she's coming from in this question, because are the parents like super harsh and legalistic because the Bible says this and you need to knock it off, you know?
Yeah.
And it's hurtful, or are the parents living a double life? Like, I think sometimes we put too much emphasis, I'll just give my opinion, much emphasis on, well, the culture is different now. Sure, it's different, but God never changes.
Sure.
And so, you know, for us, it was black and white. So it was a religious America. When I grew up, pretty much everybody, you know, I grew up in what's now called Silicon Valley.
Yeah.
But it was just the Santa Clara Valley. Then pretty much everybody went to church.
Yeah.
Now in our neighborhood, Nobody goes to church. We pull out on Sunday morning and I don't see anybody going to church.
Yeah,
so that's changed.
That's true.
But everybody was pretty much Protestant or Catholic. Okay. You know, there were a few other people into weird stuff, you know, Scientology or whatever. And the Catholics, didn't use birth control. You know who the Catholic families were, because they had 6 or 7 kids. The good thing about Catholicism is they knew who Jesus was. They knew that if you go to a Catholic church, he's on the cross.
Mm.
I had no clue who Jesus was because I went to a dead liberal church.
Mm.
All I knew,
I
believed in God. What?
We drove past recently. Yeah. You showed me for the first time.
I believed in God.
It's a beautiful building.
And I heard all the time that God is love, and that's a good thing because God is love. So I did get that, but I had no clue who Jesus was. Most Catholics, they had to go to confession on Friday.
Yep.
They couldn't eat meat on Friday. That was a rule. And they went, you had to go to confession to it, which is really weird with the priest behind a wall. But anyway, so for a Catholic to come to know Jesus, you didn't have to convince them that they were a sinner and that they, you know,
they'd
done bad things. Yeah, they knew it. Whereas I thought I was a pretty good guy because our guy never talked about sin, never talked about Jesus. So the Jesus movement was a move of the Holy Spirit. And what kind of irritates me is people that weren't there kind of look back on it and criticize it. Oh, it's a truncated gospel. You know, you just didn't want to go to hell, so you accepted Christ. And there might have been some of that with some people, not the church we got saved into. Right. It was like verse by verse to the Bible. You are all in. You are repenting of your sin.
Discipleship.
Who's on the throne of your life? Are you leading your life? For me, it was like, oh, man, I'm leading my life. I'm in a rock band. I want to be Paul McCartney, and this is what I want to do. And suddenly I'm confronted with, there is a God in heaven, and he has a plan for you. Mm-hmm. And I had to make a massive surrender, which then put me on what Jesus called the narrow way that leads to life and changed everything.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that's still what the Lord wants, but you can't talk to people the same way anymore. You have to realize everybody thinks they're spiritual and they've carved their own guy. I believe this and I believe that. And if you actually say, well, where did you get that belief? Well, I don't know. I just believe it, you know.
Whereas, and nobody is afraid of going to hell. And we were
terrified.
That was a thing
in our culture. My conversation with Sloan yesterday.
Yeah.
I have an incredible, beautiful, artistic picture on my wall that's actually Pilgrim's Progress, the famous book in artistic form. And there's a Broadway that leads to destruction, and there's flames up in the end. And then there's a narrow road that leads to life, and there's heaven. And Christian, the character in Pilgrim's Progress, is carrying this pack over his shoulder. He's carrying his burden of sin. And that's what the whole book is about. But Sloan looks at that and she goes, what's that? And I go, well, that's a depiction of hell. She goes, well, I don't want to go there. And she just started talking. We started talking about Jesus and heaven, and she believes, she knows she does, you know, bad things. Is God night? We had the greatest, deepest talk. And she basically told me she knows she's done bad things.
Take note. This is a 6-year-old.
6 years old.
Yeah.
And we got into angels, and, you know, she wants to hug Jesus. And I'm telling her, when you see him, he's going to have holes in his hands. And, you know, it was an amazing conversation.
She told me before I left.
But we don't talk about heaven and hell anymore. But, and I just explained to her that God wants everyone to be with him forever, that he doesn't send anybody there, but people who don't want to acknowledge their sin. So for us, it was like an awareness of sinfulness
and clarity.
And
it was like
clarity that God is holy, and I have to give my life to him or not. Mm-hmm. And so what was happening is people were coming alive and then they didn't know the Bible. And so we were in a church that was authentic.
And didn't know the Bible.
And it had 1,000 young people at its height from middle school through college, and they were walking with God. Diana's 15 years old. She's tithing. She's going to Bible studies. Right. She's like, and so it changed our life.
And I was tithing not because some pastor
told
me to, but because all my friends were tithing. So, okay, this is what we do. That's because so we cool. because
so, cool. so anyway, I think first. When you've experienced that, you
it's
want
different,
that's
yeah.
still what God wants for your generation.
Yes.
The same
yes.
passion, the same understanding, the same hunger for the Bible, the same desire to learn. And so we didn't see this book as a bunch of rules. We thought, oh my gosh, this is God's word to us, and I'm learning stuff I never heard before.
Sure.
And so I think that now you can't just assume that your children are just, they're not going to pick that up in the culture anywhere.
No.
They're not
going to
see do unto others as you would have to do unto you in their school class, most likely, maybe in the South or something.
Yeah.
And so I think it's still a teaching moment. And but what you're teaching is the same. Your kids need to hear the same thing we needed to hear.
Mm-hmm.
They just need it to hear it clearly and in more of a conversational
yep.
And asking questions and answering and explaining.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of like you have to build the story of the Bible underneath what you can't just proclaim truth to them, you know.
So
but you still have to proclaim truth.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we wanted our kids to
know that.
I still pray that all our grandkids will accept the Lord as Savior at a young age. And yes, then they're going to have to grow up and decide later, do I really believe this? I made that decision when I was 5 and baptized. Elizabeth was baptized when she was 10. And then, you know, when she's 18, you know, she believed it. But she had to, you know, I think you do go through a thing if you come to Christ young. Some people are like, do I believe this really?
Sure.
Am I going to follow the Lord? So I don't know. I just think we still need to proclaim the truth. So I don't know what's behind this question, but I think authenticity is really important. Like the parents need to be humble, and they need to be loving, and they need to not be judging. I think you know, I think that's what happens. Some parents are like, you know, well, hey, we, you know, and they have to be careful how they say it. So I just think it's how you relate to your kids.
Yes.
And is it judgmental and is it corrective all the time or is it in humility?
Yes.
Yeah.
And that there's a line, like you're saying, even with Sloan, that you have to, at that example, we have to, there's a line where you have to be authority in their life in a deep way.
Mm-hmm.
So I really appreciate how you summed that up at the end, what that, no matter what this gal's parents, whatever stage of life they're in, that should be their response, that there should be humility, not judgment. Like, that, I think that is the heart. But I do think that even as you guys just explained, that's a really helpful context to where they were growing up, what the situation was, where everything was. So, okay, so one more question, because I know that, unfortunately, we're not short-winded with our questions. I don't know if anyone has noticed this.
No.
But that doesn't, you know, hopefully it feels thorough to everyone. Okay, so this is an interesting one. Trying to stay hopeful with neurodiverse kids. Yeah, us too. Trying to stay hopeful with neurodiverse kids and their high needs and their prognosis. How to keep hope while also advocating/getting them resources, etc. So trying to stay hopeful with neurodiverse kids and their high needs and their prognoses.
I'm tearing up. I haven't even said anything yet.
Before you answer that, because you guys are the one to answer it, I think we have to sometimes redefine hope. Hope is not wishful thinking.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Our hope is in Christ, that he can take any situation and make it count in our lives and other people's lives, in our children's lives. And he is in the habit of making beauty out of ashes.
Yes, ma'am.
So if our hope is that everything's going to get all better, then that is a sinking sand kind of hope. But if our hope is in Jesus, who redeems beautifully really hard things, either post-fall, pre the city that is coming, and that day that all the tears will be wiped from our eyes. We live in the in-between, and our hope must be in him, not in everything getting fixed.
It's a great, really good. That's a great way to start.
Yeah, that's a great theological question. Is healing in the atonement, you know?
Yeah.
Some people say, you just got to name it and claim it, man, and you'll be healed.
Sure.
And we all will be healed, all who know Jesus. It's just a question of when. Some will be healed now of physical infirmities, and the Apostle Paul wasn't. God said, no, I'm not going to heal you because I'm going to do something unique, and I'm going to do something more powerful as you live in this weakness. But when we all are with the Lord, there's no more sickness, no more crying, no more pain. So
yes,
there is healing in the atonement. It's just a question of now. And I think there's hope. There's hope in Jesus, and there's always hope. But as far as neurodiversity, I think, Elizabeth, you need to speak to that because that's your world.
If you're enjoying this content and you want to go deeper, we have an amazing resource that we want to tell you about. It's the Intentional Film Series, Raising Passionate Jesus Followers. Now, this is an incredible tool for you for spiritual formation in the family. And we created this film series to help parents in their God-given task to raise and disciple their own children. Now, our hope is that we're able to help you and give you some of the tools that I know we so desperately need as we're in the process of raising our kids, and Phil and Diane have actually raised their kids. This is a 9-session film series on the process of what raising a passionate Jesus follower actually looks like. There's some workable solutions in here. There's a bunch of wisdom from the scriptures, and there's a bunch of practical help in your journey as you are raising your children. We cover all sorts of things like parental roles, goals versus values. What is discipline versus punishment? How do I create a heart of obedience in my child where they actually want to obey? What does a heart of self-control look like? Or how do I even help my child in the process of character development? We cover that and so many more things. You can use this film series in a variety of ways. You can use it at your home, preferably with your spouse if that's applicable, with a group of friends or in your community, or even through your local church. All you need to do is head over to our website, intentionalparents.org, click on film series, and then follow the prompts. We have a bunch of other resources there that you can check out, but we do pray that this blesses you in your pursuit of raising passionate Jesus followers.
Yeah.
Man, I love the question of how do you remain hopeful? And that, I think that's the word that made me emotional, because there are absolutely moments where it's hard to be hopeful, where you see how challenging it is for those kids to get through a day. You see the destruction it can do to relationships, to the other siblings who are sometimes at the mercy of their dysregulation or impulsivity. So I think it is really important that we do fight to remain hopeful, not by bypassing and pretending that it's not as hard as it is. I think one of the ways we stay hopeful is first by fully admitting how hard it is. And I know I've said this a million times, and I feel like anytime anybody brings up this topic, I will say it again. Those of you parenting neurodiverse kids or kids with any sort of disabilities or special needs, which I think another way to frame that is just sometimes some extra needs, you know, those high need kids, your load is heavy, and it's heavier than most parents. And a lot of times it's a completely invisible load to the average eye. And so if you feel like you're carrying a lot, it's because you are. And I think there's deep formation work that God does do, wants to do, can do because of that. I don't think anybody goes into parenting feeling like they have capacity to have neurodiverse children. God, in his grace and his mercy, gives us capacity. He gives us forgiveness when we don't get it right. But we have to be honest with the appropriate people, not honest with your kid in the moment when they're
when they've been impulsive,
like, gosh, you're so much harder than your sibling. Please don't say that. Please don't say that. But the reality is, those are the feelings that come up, and that's the truth. I mean, we've been talking about this a lot, where I'll have one conversation with our six-year-old and I will be thinking, I have never been able to have any conversation like that with our eight-year-old. And like, I have to let myself be sad about that for a second.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I can feel hopeless. Will I ever be able to have these types of conversations, you know? But with that said, I feel like the longer we've been at this, the more I see the need, and I still feel like my community around this is growing and I would like it to grow more. But we need people in our lives who are a little bit ahead of us. We need people who understand it, but I think it's especially helpful if there's people that are a little bit ahead of us who can give us a little bit of perspective. Because it's so easy, especially when your kids are on the younger side and struggling, it can be really easy to get hopeless. But when we have other pictures of parents who have gone all in and done everything they can to help their kids but can offer some perspective, it's incredibly helpful.
Yeah.
I'm thinking of the other night I was talking to my friend Abby, who is the reason the Motherhood Retreat is so beautiful. She's the reason this podcast space is so beautiful. She's a delightful, talented human. She has a 22-year-old son. Is Titus 22? She was on the podcast. We can link to that episode. 22-year-old son with autism. And she just relates so much to me with Birdie and gives me perspective and is honest about the areas that he's still really struggling and that they're worried about with him about to move out of the house. And but can instantly relate to – I'll ask her questions all the time. What did it look like when he was eight? Mm-hmm. Because I need somebody – to just give me some perspective and tell me what worked and what didn't work and what is no longer a struggle and what is still a struggle. So we need people that have gone before us. And I also think, you know, this word neurodiversity is a very broad word. Same with the word disability.
So big, yes.
You know, I wear hearing aids and have hearing loss. I have a disability versus somebody else who might say I have a disability, is in a wheelchair and has never been able to walk. I mean, the spectrum is very broad. So with our son who has dyslexia and hearing loss and ADHD, our conversations about his disability and neurodiversity are so hopeful because he's aware enough and high functioning, for lack of a better word, enough to be able to have lots of conversations around it, to confidently tell people about it, to educate himself about it. He understands where he's weak. He understands where he's strong. He understands the things he needs to focus on. There's lots and lots of hopeful conversations that we get to have. And with Birdie, those conversations are not available. Yeah. And we do our best when we see little moments and there's big question marks around her future. And I think more than anything, she has taught me and is teaching me to live one day at a time. But really, I feel like with these kids, the word season is overused. Maybe chapter is a better word. But these kids go through really hard chunks and you're doing all the therapy and it seems like it's never working. And then all of a sudden, you'll see kind of a surge of growth in one area and you're like, oh, sigh of relief. Okay, we're not as stuck as we were. And then they'll go through another season where they're very stuck and things are very hard. And so I feel like she's taught me to, when they're very hard, to remember what God has done, to ask for help, to talk to the people that I need, to talk to Abby when I need perspective. And then when she's doing a little bit better, to celebrate the this was a good day or this was a good week. You have to view it completely differently than you do with a neurotypical kid.
Wow. Yeah.
And I'm learning that.
I was going to say with neurodiverse kids, I think you have to purposefully rejoice and look for the things that you can rejoice in and then be honest about where you can't. And being honest isn't, again, with them, but it's being honest with, like, this part's really hard. But I also think that there are so many other kinds of rejoicing that you can do. So when it comes to this idea of hope, I think the hope is actually looking for where they bring this beauty into the world that otherwise wouldn't be there.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, with Bird, it's like she brings a whole perspective of life that we wouldn't see unless she was involved in our life. And that's not reframing or hopeful thinking, but I find that it's helpful to remember the – the world that she sees is so different than the world I see. And I can learn so much from her and delight in all these little funny, quirky, interesting things that she knows so much about mm-hmm. and the way that she moves through the world. And then when it's hard, I have to be really honest about the fact that it's really hard.
Yeah.
And, but I think that that helps me, I mean, move to acceptance, which helps me be more hopeful because it's like,
yeah.
I think it's part of it is that when, and Diane, I think you said this really well, is hope that it just goes away. I think hope looks like, well, can we live a full life with her? And I have hope that we can live a very yeah. full, rich life yeah. with her. And will it look different? Totally. It already looks very different, but not in a bad way. Not in a way that I'm like, oh gosh, this is so hard. It's just different. And the more we move into the different and can accept how different it is, mm-hmm. the more I feel hope
yeah.
that she has a full life ahead. And, but it's just, it's so daily. It's so hard. And
yeah. Moment. It's so moment by moment. Can yeah. I
Wait, she's gonna
talk
say.
To the dads for a minute?
Yeah.
Yeah.
This is a mom asking the question. Yeah.
I think so.
Maybe.
I didn't look.
You dads who are listening, your wife needs you to be in it with her. I'm going to get teary because you are in it with me. But I hear so often, and we've had times where this has been how we've operated. So often it's the mom who is learning and researching and going to all of the appointments and reading the books. And really it's a new language. It's a new way of parenting. It requires mm-hmm. you to learn. It does. If you have a neurodiverse child, you now need to educate yourself.
Yeah.
You do have to learn. But so often it's the moms who are doing that, understandably, mm-hmm. totally understandably. And the dads oftentimes don't enter into that with their wife. Mm-hmm. And I think there's usually going to be a primary parent who is maybe initiating the learning. But you dads need to join your wife in that, because if you are able to do that, then you actually might be the main one who can give her hope,
mm-hmm.
especially if she mm-hmm. is the main caregiver or with that child more. She mm-hmm. is going to need a constant, steady stream of hope that is not reframing, it's going to be fine, you're making too big of a deal of this. That none of that is helpful. That's why you have to be in it with her and learn with her, because you need to understand what is happening. You need to understand how your child is different, and you need to understand the load that your wife is carrying and join her in it.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like I see it and hear it so often of moms feeling like, I'm all in, I'm trying to do this, but my husband is just triggered by it and we can't even talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
And I have so much empathy and compassion for that. We understand that. We've
totally
been there.
Understand that.
But
yeah.
you can't stay there. Mm-hmm. And to the wife listening, you're not going to motivate your husband by shaming him into that. You have to invite him in, lovingly, gently tell him what you need and that what would make you feel really loved. You also have to be aware of your own expectations. He's not going to do it exactly like you. But you need to help bring him into that process. And I think we did that wrong for a lot of years. I took it all on and then just informed him, and then was mad when he didn't do it exactly how I had informed him he should. And I think we're slowly learning how to do it together, how to
give each
other breaks.
We've been together for a lot of years, but there's seasons, and I think that's life. Like you can't be where you're not. And it was a new dynamic that we didn't even know. Like,
yeah,
it's easier to see that and say it now and be like, oh, here's, but I mean, honestly, that was from us having to learn the hard way.
Yeah, you're just trying
like,
to
survive. Like, oh, I'm trying to take on this end, you take on that end. Mm-hmm. And of course, it wasn't my heart to be disconnected from what was going on with the education of how to actually yeah. live in this space. But it was, as soon as I became aware of it and was like, oh, you're basically running this part and I'm just trying to provide for the family. Mm-hmm. We need to come more center.
Yeah.
That was really helpful. But it wasn't malicious. It was just two levels of stress in different directions. And you're trying to put out this fire. I'm trying to put out this fire. And, mm-hmm. But we found that was really hard, and it's been exponentially easier. And interestingly enough, with Bird, I can tap into things with her that for whatever reason is really, and I don't mean that like boastful. I'm saying as a dad, for whatever reason, she has a level of openness with me. Mm-hmm. That is sometimes surprising even to me, surprising to you, it's just surprising to me. And there's a, we all play a part and it's really us together, because she'll open up to you with certain things, but then she'll open up to me, and it's really important to have, like, to be on the same page with what's going on, because it's really interesting how that can happen with neurodiverse kids. So anyway, I think that's a really good question. You were going to say something.
It's probably going on too long right now, so I'll keep it really quick. Okay. But you, Elizabeth, address the dads. I want to address the grandparents, because I feel like I've learned a lot.
Yes, please.
In this whole journey, I started off probably saying and doing everything wrong, and you've brought me along really well. So just a couple of thoughts, the grandparents. If you're not actually at home with this child, living the everyday, putting him to bed every night, introducing new foods, making him do what they don't want to do, then you're not seeing the whole child. So because we're not living in your home, we're not making our grandkids do anything they don't want to do, pretty much, or introducing challenging things to them. We see a different side of Birdie. And the neurodiversity we see are at her best. So what we see is the result of your years of therapy and your training. It'd be very easy for us to think that you are overstating things, or because she really is, and because she is more, her tendency is to not be sensory seeking, but to be sensory, adverse?
Avoidant.
Okay.
Yeah.
She shuts down. And you could view her shutting down as good behavior. Because she doesn't rock the boat when she shuts down. And then she goes home, and then it all comes out.
There's no problem with rocking the boat at home.
No problem whatsoever.
It's like she's perfectly behaved at our house. But, you know, obviously we've lived near each other and enough that I've seen everything. Mm. So for a grandparent, if you really want to help your kids and you want to help their marriage, I think there are just a few things that are really important. Don't allow yourself to put a little chipper face on it. Don't feel like you have to cheer your kids up about this. Don't feel like you need to tie every conversation up with a nice little red bow, because God has got this and he's going to take care of it. And you know, he knows what he's doing and he's in control. I don't believe, for one thing, my theology doesn't allow me to believe that neurodiversity is actually God's will. For Birdie or for any other child. It is a result of the fall. Sure. Our DNA is affected. Our environment is affected. And we don't even know all the reasons why brains become, quite honestly, damaged at some point in time, so they don't function the way they're supposed to. So to bypass like that and to put a chipper face on it, I think just sends your adult kids underground.
Yes.
Or allows them to be in denial, which is the last thing your grandchild needs. They need their parents to be completely alert of every symptom and real confident in their judgment. Elizabeth, how many times have I said to you, your judgment is so solid, trust your gut, because she is, I mean, I can say that because this is true about you. Don't bypass, like it's all going to be, you know, I love these two words that you use, reframing and bypassing. Learn what those terms mean and avoid them at all costs. You can't fix this for you kids. You can't make it all better.
But you can
help. I think
help.
The word that God gave us was no, but we can come alongside them and we can offer them some shade, just some relief, some date nights where we don't have to tell them everything that went wrong and every argument that happened and every meltdown and that they wouldn't go to sleep. We just let them have a good evening. We say it was great. She was great.
Well, Birdie will tell us absolutely everything that happened today. Today, before we were coming here, she was like sitting on the carpet, chewing on her toes. This is the latest. This is her latest sensory self-soothing thing, is chewing on her hands and her feet. And I asked her to stop. I said, don't chew on your hands. Go get your – she has like a chew necklace. And she goes, I chewed my toes yesterday at all my pop's house. Okay. Thank you for telling me, Birdie. Thank you for telling me.
So – and then ask your kids what they need. Don't assume you know what they need. I mean, I'm mom. A little bit I know what you need.
Yeah.
But don't assume.
You need to ask kids what is the need right now?
Because the need right now is very different than it was, you know, 4 or 5 years ago.
Big time.
And then the other one is to ask, if you're watching these neurodiverse kids and you're noticing unusual behavior or, you know, a great meltdown or something like that, or a super difficult surge of anxiety, call that child up, you know, the parent up, and say, how do you want me to handle this particular situation? Mm-hmm. Because the rules are completely different than a child who's
neurotypical.
Okay, yeah, yeah. See, learn the language.
The words changed. Now there's a different, neurodivergent is being used more than neurodiverse. The words change constantly.
Okay, well, keep up with it.
Yes.
But how do you want me to handle this? And how many times, Elizabeth, have you walked me through, okay, now do this. This is like foreign territory to me. I had foreign neurotypical kids.
Yeah. I disagree, but keep going.
I do question a little bit, but I'm pretty much.
At the time.
Pretty much, you know, and so. What happens, I think, is I've seen this enough times that a grandparent just slaps an old adage on it.
Yes.
And it doesn't work, it's not helpful. Yeah. In fact, it just sends your kids pushing you away.
Yes.
They have to push you away. The other thing that has been so helpful to me is when you've included me in the reports at first of when you went to the pediatric developmental
Neuropsychologist.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah.
First, showing me the reports, letting me ask questions like, I don't understand this word and things like that. Yeah. And then letting me actually be a, when Zoom calls started happening, letting me actually be a silent spectator on those phone calls.
Yeah.
So I'm hearing, I'm seeing the psychologist's
the fancy guy,
I'm seeing the expressions on his face, I'm seeing the expressions in your faces, I've said I just want to be a fly in the wall, I'm not contributing, I'm not asking questions, that's really important because you're not the parent, but it has helped me so much to understand what the doctors are saying about this grandchild who I love ferociously. But now I also understand in a way that I couldn't have had you not brought me along with that. So there's my just little tidbits, because I think most grandparents, when they see a diagnosis like this, we really want to help. And we're clueless enough that we can hurt our kids. I know, I'm sure I hurt you in the beginning. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. Oh, I don't. I think you were so humble. You both were. To let me explain. Mm-hmm. Like, you set the stage for me to be able to explain. I never felt judgment from you over, you know, because typically what it looks like when they're really young is it's a lot of behaviors that are driven by different things.
Yeah.
And I feel like you guys have always been open to let me teach you and explain. And that is, you are naturally a learner. I am naturally a learner, teacher. Mm-hmm. Like,
it's almost a version of control.
Totally.
What I understand, I can control.
So that's not everybody's scenario. No. But I do think, regardless of how the mom is responding or the parents are responding, to have the grandparents with a posture of, we want to understand. Will you help us understand?
Yeah.
You just start there. We want to understand.
And you guys do a great job at that. You got, both of you do an incredible job of making sure that it works for us and who are our kids, what's happening now in this situation. Mm-hmm. And it's tricky because sometimes it's really, because sometimes it does look like this is just bad behavior, you know, and there's so many times, even recently, where I've been watching my kids and I know what's going on. I understand all, like, you understand the whole thing. And, you know, my old instincts would have been to respond to that as, oh, you're out of line or whatever. And like, oh man, I'm so thankful I know what I know, because this looks like really bad behavior or disrespect, but really there's so many other things going on under the surface. There's so much. Deep hurt, pain, you know, so many different things going on.
One mistake I do know I made at the beginning is because she has sensory issues. I would say, well, I kind of do too. You know, like I go into the store and I have to stop myself because I want to touch everything. And I would talk about going to the mall and I don't like all the lights, mm-hmm. you know, especially you lose your one sense. Sometimes it aggravates another one. And you put a really gentle stop to it when you said, yes, but you have the ability to evaluate it and to see it and put a stop to it. Like I can go into a clothing store. I love texture. Mm-hmm. So I can go into a clothing store and put my hands in my pockets because I know that it's probably not a good thing to get my greasy hands over every single piece of clothing.
Or you can go home and change your clothes if your pants are feeling uncomfortable. Or you can pop gum in your mouth.
Recognize it.
Yes.
Yes.
You can do something about it.
And with people with true sensory difficulties and challenges, they can't. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It just so dysregulates them.
Yeah.
So those kind of things, I think it's really important to let yourself be corrected and say, oh, okay, I get this.
Yeah.
We could keep going.
We could keep going forever.
But the problem is that we must come to a close for today. So keep sending questions. Thank you for everybody that sent them in, whether through email, Instagram. Keep them coming. Thank you for listening today.